some guidance on the report and the issue of publication, of the time issues regarding publication and comment, and what our views are on that. I wanted to talk about the two additional inputs, one of them being the implementation report from the committee, and Steve very kindly and wonderfully did a draft on that. And I wanted to talk about the contribution from the European Commission from the internal market at the at the European Commission. It's important to note that it does come. This did not come through a broad commission process, and the consultation that we have been offered would be back with the data protection section of the internal market.
Marilyn, you've just started echoing significantly.
Is that any better?
Nope.
No, I hear that. I don't think that's actually my phone. I think there's... Is there an echo on... Like we should have someone else speak.
Well, I'll speak.
You sound fine.
Do I produce echo?
No. Am I still producing echo?
Seems to have gone.
Yeah, that seems to have gone.
Because if we keep having this problem, then I will give you my personal bridge, and I'll call Tony, and we'll go off this bridge onto another one. If it's that would be the quickest thing for us to do. But let me wait until Abel joins first. So the European Commission submission, and then Thomas's efforts to create a updated draft, and then the issues report, and that will hopefully. We'll be able to end by 12:30. If let's make that our goal. The conversation with Bruce. But before I do that, does anyone else need to add anything or want to add anything to the agenda? The conversation with Bruce was something like the following. I think he was learning a lot about the complexities of trying to move these processes forward. And he suggested that if there is a... I am not clear. I had asked for a decision and have not gotten an answer back from yet from the ICANN staff, so I need to do that again, on whether we have to follow the PDP process, which would have a 20-day comment period. Given that we have been out there and doing all this commenting previous to now. Who just joined us?
Abel, hi.
Great. We've all agreed that Glenn will send us all a reminder now on a weekly basis.
I've searched all over it. I couldn't find the numbers. Nowhere.
But you posted a this number, which will be the number all the way through, and maybe that's our problem. So we need to talk about what our view is about how much further comment is needed and what is really practical. One suggestion that he made is if we feel that there is any area that needs further comment, that we pull that out and treat that differently. With a longer period of comment if we feel that that's necessary, but try to move forward the bulk of the report so that it can be voted on by the Names Council on the 20th and then presented to the board. So if we feel that there is a particular area that needs further comment, then we need to address that area as a that as a sort of separate track. And as we go through this, we can talk about whether there is one that falls into that category. The second thing that is required by the PDP are impact statements by the constituencies. And again, I'm not clear on whether we should be viewing this document as falling under that, but we would certainly have time from the time that we post it to ask the constituencies to do impact statements. Bruce did not suggest that, and thought that the responsibility of going back to each of the groups should lie with the representation that is in the group, that is whoever's there from that constituency. But I think we need to talk about whether we think impact statements are needed and just be clear on why we're not recommending them if we're not. And that, I think, would be because, in this case, the policy report has been undertaken really before the PDP came into existence, and has accommodated a lot of existing a lot of previous opportunities for comments, et cetera. But we should resolve that question about impact statements and then verify it with the staff, and we can try to do that by email. So that's sort of the extent of my conversation with Bruce, except for the final issue, which I think I reported on, and that is that previously, and that is that the issues report are on a different timeline and will be presented in Rio for first consideration by the council. So the issues folks, and I think this was in my last summary, the issues folks have a bit more time, and that's very welcome by all of us. Okay. If everyone's in agreement, then I think we should go to the discussion about the report of the implementation committee. Is that okay?
Steve, I'm going to call on you, if that's okay.
Okay. I think I sent around an email after the last meeting of the implementation committee, which several of this task force were on that call, stating that it seemed to be that the draft implementation committee report was close enough to what the final report was going to be that it would make sense for us to draft in parallel a section of our submission that reacts to the implementation committee report. So that's what I tried to do in the document that was sent around last night.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes through what the implementation committee said and gives reactions to it, which are basically to accept most of their changes. I think where it gets a bit complicated is on their their comments on requiring our recommendation that I can tell them under the registrar advisory that they should ask for documentary proof of the accuracy of the corrected data. And they conclude that was not implementable. They came up with an alternative, which I think is basically consistent with what we intended, but it has some couple of areas where I think as I went through that each paragraph of what they recommended, I think there are a couple of areas where we should not accept their recommendation or incorporate their recommendation, and in some cases because we have a separate recommendation on the topic, for example on the 15-day, 30-day issue, and in other cases because it's just their recommendation is just not completely worked out yet, and this has to do with their suggestion that there be some entirely new dispute resolution procedure for resolving issues. So in the long run that may make sense, but I think in terms of implementing in shorter term, it's probably not practical. So that's the basis for what I have in there about accuracy on bulk access. I think their only recommendation was that we should clarify the definition of marketing purposes, and I think we would agree with that.
Are we open for comments? Okay, I missed part of these calls, unfortunately, but I did thoroughly read your report, Steve. Thanks very much for it. It was very clear. And I'm a little amazed at the lightweight sense of this, of these recommendations of texts which the registrars have made here, because they're not really doing much to validate data. And there were some examples from Rick Wesson in a mail recently of different situations where there was a complaint about invalid data and what happened afterwards. And they say that if you ask for hard proof of is the data correct or not, something like a telephone bill, well, if it comes from another country, then you're in a language problem and things like this. But if you don't make it tough on people who have bad faith by obliging them to do complicated things, I mean, you're not going to get anywhere with this. That's the way I see it. It's not too difficult to say if somebody has twice sent invalid data, he's proved that he's acting from bad faith. From then on, you can just graduate sanctions against him in the way of saying, well, you've got to send a bill certified by a public notary, a telephone bill, and if it's in Greek, you have to have it translated by a public notary and send it by physical hard copy. And if you have to check a telephone number, you should be able to call the registrant as a condition for renewing his registration and charge him for that call.
Can I ask a question that I've never heard discussed? And I was on the last call, and on one previous one, but I've never heard this discussed. How is it that these registrars are able to take a registration in the first place? They must be taking the registration. The registration is being made, and they have accepted payment.
Exactly.
Now, there are registrars who have an extremely creative business model of giving names away, oddly, non-sustainable model, as far as I might notice, but the majority of these names they're taking payment for, and they communicated with them the first time.
Sure.
So.
And they were concerned about receiving the payment correctly, and safeguards were obviously in place, either credit card or any other system. I don't know if there is an alternative to credit card. But definitely they're interested in getting payment, right?
Yeah, but that's what I wrote earlier. I mean, let's be honest, the majority of these domains is paid by credit card.
Right.
And in order to have a valid credit card payment, which is in their own interest, seeing as when it's not valid, they'll get a chargeback, they will have to do an AVI, an address check. Yeah? So the address on the card should be correct. So how can they allow a different address on the domain than that the client's given them on the card?
Well,
if I register a domain, I can register it as Mickey Mouse living anywhere in Hollywood, but they do check my credit card, and my credit card says that I'm Abel Wiseman.
Yeah.
But you might run into situations where an executive from a company might register a domain name for the company and use the credit card with his name on it. Right, and
in that case, he becomes the admin contact.
Right,
but the domain is in name of the company, which has another address, but he remains the admin contact.
Yes, that's the point.
Did someone else just join us?
Oh, this is Christy. We addressed this point, I think, after you left the call, Marilyn, on Thursday. Bruce said that he was just saying we were communicating with the registrant. And in the event that the registrant's data is incorrect, you know, we're all admin contacts for a lot of domains. So maybe our information is correct, and we can respond, but maybe we cannot respond with updated, you know, information about the person's address because there is no update because they haven't moved. And the data is correct. And they didn't say what they were going to do in that case either.
Okay, I don't want to lose Marilyn's point, which I think was very, really very, very good. When you when this guy contacts you and he wants a domain name, that's where you've got him in a place where you can do something, right? Before you give him his domain name. And one thing you could do is say, okay, you paid for it, you've given me this, you filled in a template with all this data for the whois, everything I've asked you for, that's great, and you paid with your credit card. Now you have to mail me proof of data. I have to get this within 30 days by mail, or else I'll put your domain name on hold. And then you oblige everybody automatically to validate the data they're giving you. Okay?
Okay. Suggestion. The registrars, if I can kind of struggle with this for a minute, against our initial recommendation. And, Steve, I will say on the two calls, the calls that I've listened in on, I have been disappointed at the lack of expressed enthusiasm on the part of the registrars for responsibility for accuracy.
They look at it from a cost point of view, Marilyn. You know, what they get, what's left for them after they pay the registry is what, maybe $2-3, and where can we pay for this? That's what they're saying.
But we're not talking in this case about their bearing the cost for notice, right? And I believe that there was recognition that if there were additional costs for for finding, sending paper mail, et cetera, that there needed to be a way for them to recover those kinds of costs.
They should charge more for the domain name.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but why are we responsible for their margins? They can up their margins.
Right.
No, I think, in fact, we're not commenting on... I'm just struggling with what our original recommendation was and what the implementation committee's...
Are we referring here to the... There are really three situations here. One is at the time of renewal. Well, there's four situations. One is at the time of registration. We didn't have a consensus in our group,
right,
that we should recommend that they change what they do at the time of registration. I am all for that, but not everyone on our group was. The second point is at the time of renewal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the... There we said they should... Registrants should be required to review and validate. And the implementation committee said, well, that really means we present them with the current WHOIS information, tell them that they can lose their domain name if they give false information, and require them to to say, yes, I reviewed it and it's fine, or here are the corrections. I'm not sure that's too far off from what we initially recommended.
Yep. What did they say at that point about, because I heard part of a discussion about, well, the data is clearly wrong. You can eyeball it and know it's wrong. There's no such telephone number as XXXXXXXXX.
Well, I think some of the registrars do not want to be in a situation where anything depends on them eyeballing anything. They want the entire, they don't want a human being involved.
Uh-huh.
They want the entire system to be automated.
Exactly.
I think inevitably that at some point or other that system is not going to be sufficient. But
even an automated system would reject,
yes,
a
right,
telephone number of...
Well, that's the third point, which, I mean, they basically are saying just to back up, we didn't have consensus in our group that that should be a basis for denying somebody the registration in the first place if they say that their phone number is XXX. Second stage is renewal. They've been in the system with this phone number. Now they're told to look at it again and tell me that it's accurate. And if they do that, they get to renew. Again, the registrars didn't want to have any further screen there. And it comes down to whether, when we say review and validate, does it mean more than giving the registrant an opportunity to make any needed corrections? The third situation is after a complaint has been received. Now it's not just that it's in the system. Someone, anyone, someone has stood up and said, "No, this is wrong. This data is not accurate." And that's the situation that most of this, most of the discussion was directed at that circumstance. And that's where the problem comes in. They said they agreed that a registrar has to take some steps, apply some heuristic automated data validation techniques, possibly via automated tool centrally provided by ICANN, to check that the new WHOIS information is plausible. So presumably, XXX as a phone number would be deemed not plausible. Now, one of the concerns that I raised at that point was, what happens if it is deemed not plausible? And that's where it's not clear from what they put forward. There was a lot of discussion about that on the call with the implementation committee. And I've given in this document what I think should be at least now the outcome, which is that if they submit that and it doesn't even pass the straight face test based on these automated techniques, then it shouldn't be sufficient. Unless and obviously at that point a human being has to get involved and actually use some common sense and decide whether or not to allow this registration to continue in effect.
And
exactly.
This is in stage three when a complaint has been received, right?
Right. Now, stage four is, let's say someone, you know, the complaint's been received, the request has gone out, and after however many days, there's been no response, so the registration goes into registrar hold, it's taken out of the zone file. Then the question is, how do you get back in? And I think that's a situation where I suppose it would be to be the toughest, because you've had an opportunity to correct it in response to a complaint. You didn't do it. If you come in later, presumption in effect ought to be against you at that point. That's the situation. I don't think that the implementation committee has really dealt with that. They've kind of passed that off to the deletes task force, I think. But I just don't see how they've responded on that. That's stage four. But I think the question is, at what point does a human being have to get involved? And I think their answer is nowhere. And our answer would, I guess I suggest that our answer would be at least at stage three.
You know, the deletions task force has a couple of paragraphs that we also need to address. Let me just read you the relevant paragraph. And this is about deleted names. In most respects, the name deleted for reasons related to inaccuracy of WHOIS data is treated identically to a name deleted for any other reason. Now, this is kind of interesting because we were assuming that a name was on register hold, but it was out of the zone file as opposed to...
At some point, it will be deleted.
Yeah. However, it is important to prevent registrants from using the redemption grace period to simply reinstate names once they have been deleted without providing accurate WHOIS information. In order to prevent this, the task force recommends that registrars require that registrants of such names provide new, verified WHOIS information. This new data should be provided as part of the documentation to the registry in conjunction with the name's redemption.
Okay, but that still leaves open the question of what does new verified data mean?
It does, but you know, the definition of new verified WHOIS information may need to be defined. But it seems to me that the intent in this by this task force, the deletions task force, verified to most people means there is some kind of substantiation behind it. If it's a phone number, you've called that number to see if, in fact, it's a real number. It works. It rings. It gets answered. You might.
So
Sorry.
I mean, if it's a postal address, you just send them some kind of a secret URL with a password in it, so only the recipient of the message can verify the domain name. Then you ask them to. You also demand that they have some kind of secret, which is used for managing the domain name anyway. And this, so in this case, the only person which can basically acknowledge receipt of this message is the domain name holder if he gets the message. Once you use these data versus the systems of the registrar, you have proof that the address is accurate. And that way you can avoid some of the problems Steve described with respect to step three. If this kind of data is included in a written notice for domain for address verification, then it ultimately does not matter how long after the end of the 15 days I enter this address. At the moment I enter it, I mathematically prove that I have gotten this message. So that problem isn't there. I think maybe we should really try to think about all this in terms of practical processes in order to verify this or that particular data element and really look at individual processes. Well, just an idea.
Yeah. I heard a fair amount of concern on the part of the registrars about introducing any kind of checks into the process because of the issues of cost. So Steve, and I think Machika, you were on the last call, and Tony Thomas, when we look at what they have agreed to, can we just identify the areas where we feel that the implementation group is not supported by the task force first?
Is not what, Marilyn?
Not supported by the task force.
Well, I think, Marilyn, this is Ritika. I think they have enough technical complexity issues to deal with, as we just discussed right now. And actually, the thought I had in listening to the meeting was maybe we need to apply their implementation in a specified constrained test bed. Like maybe just.
Could you say that again? I'm sorry, I lost you.
Sorry, just apply the implementation committee's recommendations to like the .com. Top level domain, as opposed to letting it, having everyone adopt it right away. So it just seems to me it's very complex. There's going to be lots of complications. We may just want a limited test bed.
Well, if I may make a comment on that, I somehow have doubts that the single biggest GTLD is an appropriate test.
No, I mean, I think I know
where I first read the suggestion to basically use .com as a test bed, and I very much respect the thoughts behind that, but I don't think .com is the appropriate place to play around with something like that, quite frankly.
I'm not sure that this test bed idea would reduce complexity. I think it would add complexity because these registrars handle registrations for all the different GTLDs.
Right.
So
yep.
They would have to have a different path for, .net or whatever it turns out to be than they have for .com. I just think that would make it even more complicated.
Has there ever been any discussion, Steve, in the implementation group about I heard discussions. I heard registrars wringing their hands about people abusing the system and making false claims of inaccurate data. But has there been any discussion that any of you have heard about the volume of complaints that they have had to respond to so far about inaccurate data?
Well, no. The only information that we had on that was from Dan Halloran's briefing in Shanghai, which I circulated previously, and it didn't seem like it was a huge volume.
Because
pretty much spread proportionally across the registrars.
Right. Because one thing that occurred to me is there was a discussion, right, about the need to sort of have a gating or a standard process for how the complaints about inaccuracy are made.
Right. And we recommended that the ICANN continue to have the standard complaint form.
Right.
That is main channel. It wouldn't necessarily be the only one, but it would be the main channel for making those complaints.
You know, it seems to me that that does provide something of a safeguard in an interesting way. People are having to submit that complaint to the standard process, which ICANN can sort of randomly eyeball from time to time, or if a registrar complains that they are being that they're receiving a very high number of complaints, the ICANN staff, there clearly there could be a there's the ability to review the process. I also heard a comment about the fact that we had not built in a review of the process, and I think that that's probably a good comment to capture. But my comment on the call was it needs to be a meaningful period of time.
Right. I mean, on your first point, Marilyn, at least as of the time of the Shanghai meeting, ICANN was eyeballing everything that came in through that complaint form.
Right.
And they were discarding things that seemed totally irrelevant. So, again, the volume was not so great that they could do that. And, you know, I think what's relevant here is we heard on a call, when we had the call with .ca, for example, which is a registry, not, you know, not the size of .com, obviously, but it is bigger than some of the GTLDs. And they look at every single registration that comes in, and if the contact data appears incomplete or wrong, then they ask the registrar to check it out again. So at the registry level, they're able to handle this. I agree with you that I don't think there is any that the volume of complaints is not really, it's not really the basis for an objection here. At least it hasn't been so far.
Well,
and I think that the registrars just don't want to have a system where they have to look at any of these and have anybody spend any human being spend any time dealing with them. They want it all automated.
Thomas here. Can I get into the queue?
Sure.
There is one community you should not neglect when designing an abuse mechanism, and that is vocal anti-spam activists. These guys are, I'm sorry, I have to say that these guys
Thomas,
are frequently
I can't hear you. Sorry.
Sorry. I said, think about the more violent parts of the anti-spam community. There are a number of loose guns around there who will quickly find any complaint mechanism and basically submit automatic queries for or automated complaints for about any spam they get. They will use every tool available for them, and I have in fact had one case I accidentally triggered a takedown of a website through such a thing by just recommending a URL on a mailing list. And you have to expect that these people will produce at some point of time a significant amount of accuracy complaints. So this is something not to be kept out of mind. This is something to be kept inside. You have to, if we design a mechanism where we have some automatic data gathering and some complaint mechanism, it will be used. It will be used more than we like it, I suppose. So I don't really buy the argument to say, okay, we have it in first experimental stage, basically, and it wasn't too much so far, so let's assume it will stay that way. I don't think we can make that assumption.
Well, this is Steve. You're right. There certainly might be abuse. There hasn't been abuse so far. We don't know how long it will last, but I think when paragraph A of their recommendations, they say, I mean, you see the response there,
I can hardly hear you, Steve.
Okay, I'm sorry. We suggest that there be a field in the complaint form in which the complainant is asked to provide a brief justification for or evidence in support of the complaint. I mean, yeah, there should be some mechanism some speed bump that has to be traversed before you can make such a complaint.
Okay, so guys, Becky wanted to speak, and then I wanted to offer a recommendation.
I just wanted to point out, maybe people didn't see this, but there was a story yesterday that Nominet had to take down its Whois again, this time because of some data mining for spam. So I think we should expect to meet some resistance to the sense that it's that WHOIS data is not used for spam?
I think we need to address that under Becky. I think we do need to address that under our next under the topic of bulk access and on the issues gating access to.
I'm sorry. Am I the only one who has a horrible lot of line noise in this call? I really can hardly hear anything. I'm sorry.
I think someone's maybe doing some work in the background or moving things around. So maybe you could mute your phone if that's the case. Oh, it's so quiet now.
I don't think, by the way, that this Nominet thing, I'll send the story out, was a bulk access issue. That's the only...
No, Becky, it was data mining on port 43.
Yeah.
But what I started to say is I think we actually need to address this port 43 issue very... And so let's do that. Let's move through this, and then let's address the other issue about bulk access and about port 43 mining. There's a couple of things that occurred to me that I wanted to raise with people. First of all, if the form requires you to fill in information about why you know the data is inaccurate, then there's some substantiation there, and I assume that the reports still are going to... If reports for inaccuracy still go to ICANN first and then are sent to the registrar, as opposed to going directly to the registrar, is that what we're envisioning?
Well, that's certainly one method that one path they could follow. I should say that what ICANN is doing now of looking at each complaint. That's not really spelled out in the protocol. They're doing that, but it isn't a requirement for them to do that.
We didn't spell it out,
and they didn't spell it out
right.
When they established this mechanism
right.
9 months ago.
Right. Maybe that's a question for this task force to both consider and make a recommendation on. If the reports go directly to the registrars, I think that may be more difficult for the registrars to manage than if they go through ICANN. The other thing that we did envision, as I recall, we thought there had to be a tracking number for ICANN for complaints.
Yes, we did recommend that. This is not in the implementation committee's report because they only looked at the things that were directed to the registrars, not to what ICANN should do.
Right. But I think maybe we could take some learning out of this and enhance this area of our recommendation. If we believe that the reports, and perhaps this is the way to make it a test bed, but in a different sort of way. For now, complaints should still go to a central site at ICANN using a standard form that needs to include the justification for why the complainant believes the data is inaccurate. That allows the ICANN staff to have some sense of the numbers of complaints that are being received and also to have a little bit of a sense of what kind of information is being provided on the...
Hello? Anyone still there?
Mm-hmm. Someone's moving their phone and it's very hard to press here.
Marilyn?
Yeah?
Speaking to your point, Christy, the form that they fill out that would be first sent to ICANN, well, the validation that happens before the form information is sent in an email message could include some basic validation mechanisms like checking to see if the phone number field has the correct number of numbers in it or if it's indeed a valid email address by pinging it. And there are some different kind of automated mechanisms that could be done there just to verify that they, you know, should even take the time to read the message.
ICANN could use a simple program on the automated forms they receive.
Right. Well, if you're gonna assign an ID number to each message received, you might as well use a SQL database.
Right.
And so you might as well assign that number right when the first message is received. And you might as well validate the data that's going into the database before it goes in.
The other thing that would let ICANN gather statistics on the different kinds of complaints that are received.
Valid and invalid complaints, et cetera, et cetera. And it also simplifies reporting and forwarding information to registrars or registries, whatever is decided.
How is that compatible with our recommendation that ICANN should publish a list of contact points at registrars? We are actually recommending that the ICANN form should only be one way to file complaints and that there should be another way to file them directly with registrars.
But Thomas, I think that that's the whole purpose of the implementation and the further discussion is to say, is our original recommendation really still sound, or have we learned something else that caused us?
I was just trying to point out that the way in which we are going at this point would mean that we would have to step back from that particular recommendation, and that we basically would have to say that if, for instance, we say, okay, there should be a test period, during the test period, use this centralized submission point in order to generate statistics, that would also have to mean that during the test period, direct contact points should not be published, because it would be counterproductive.
All right, but it seems to me, and I wanted to run this past people, it seems to me that approach would do a couple of things. It certainly would gather the kind of information so we would know whether or not the registrars, in fact, are being deluged with complaints or not. We would know what kinds of complaints are being received. We would know whether there's a lot of inaccuracy or failure to fill out the complaint information, and my sense at the ICANN staff level would have the discretion to discard complaints which are obviously frivolous, and that could be implemented as a test period, but implemented across all registries and all registrars, and suspend the list of contacts at this point would be provided to the ICANN staff.
Well, I just have two. This is Steve. I have two comments on that. One, I think that does fairly well characterize the system as it works now, and I hope we're not buying into the supposition that the system is being abused now, because I don't think there's any basis for concluding that. Second, does that mean that if some people, hard as it may be to believe, some people don't really know very much about ICANN or never been to the internic.net site. It's hard to imagine why anyone would have a need to go there in most cases. And therefore, they may not know about this mechanism.
Right, Steve, but the registrars, if you'll pardon me for just a brief second, could provide a link to that one point of contact.
Right.
It's simple to just network. I mean, they just network it right into their website, and no one even has to know they're internic.net. They just know they're filling out a complaint.
We did recommend, actually, that they provide a link to this site.
Right,
and we also recommended there be a tracking number. So we were envisioning that there had to be some sort of ability for ICANN to keep track of this anyway. The only thing I think this, and Steve, I'm not suggesting that I'm buying into the idea that this is being abused, but I heard on the calls, and I have heard separately from registrars, that they are concerned that over time that there will be a huge growth in the submission of spurious inaccuracy claims as a means to try to steal someone's name, et cetera. And I think we may think they're erring on the side of caution or being too cautious. But I'm trying to come up with a solution which meets the objectives of the task force and also takes into account the concerns of the implementation committee. which was why I was proposing this as a test period, at which then an evaluation could be done. I think that based on that evaluation, then the decision could be made about changing the implementation. Can I hear others' comments on this? Because I'm not suggesting we change much else in our recommendation on this particular issue.
So, I'm sorry, could you what do you want to change it to here?
Becky, for a period of time, we would like to ensure that the complaints go through ICANN, where they are then redistributed to the appropriate registrar, and ICANN gather a limited amount of statistics on the kinds of complaints that are received and where the volume is and whether they are getting a high number of spurious complaints.
Okay, and would so how would ICANN would then investigate the complaints?
No. ICANN would do what they do today. They eyeball the complaints and they send the complaint off to the registrar to follow up on, and then they keep track of whether the registrar reports back to them.
Okay, so that's the reporting requirement is then the registrar reports back.
Yeah, now that is new, by the way, because as you know, the largest registrar and perhaps some others do not report back to ICANN on the outcome of the complaint.
But
I think we could recommend that they do that. But
right.
Well, we can write it right into the process, too.
Actually, Steve, I had assumed we were recommending that they report back, and I'm surprised to see that we don't think we did that.
We recommend that the form should incorporate a simple automated mechanism for the registrar to report back to ICANN on the outcome of complaints.
Oh, that's what I thought.
The reason was one registrar said, we're not paid to do this, and we don't have a contractual requirement to do it, so we're not going to do it.
If we nitpick, the current text only contains an obligation for ICANN to provide registrars with an opportunity and does not contain an obligation for them to make use of that. Well, so I think from the wording, there would be a different, requiring them to report back would still be a different one.
Do we maybe want to advance that text to provide the opportunity for the registrars to even use an automated mechanism to let ICANN know what's going on with the complaint and the complainant?
Well, it's not so much about that. We just would have to say provide an opportunity to report back and registrars, please do it, use it. That's a missing link.
I'm not there yet on the idea that I'm surprised I missed that, because basically we're saying we hope you'll report back. We're not saying you need to report, you have to report back. They have a contractual obligation to maintain accurate data.
By the way, as you might recall on the call, Marilyn, they do not think they have that obligation. They think it's the registrant's obligation, not theirs. Which is a problem.
maybe we actually need to talk to the ICANN staff a bit about who does have this obligation. I am under the impression that when an ISP has a customer who is I'm trying to think of an analogy in an adjacent market here, but when an ISP has a customer who gives them false and inaccurate data, and law enforcement comes to the ISP to contact that registrant, I just find it odd that they don't think they've signed a contract with ICANN that says they will maintain accurate data. Now, maybe
they signed a contract with ICANN that says they will require the registrant to provide accurate data and that they have the authority to terminate to cancel the registration if it's not accurate.
But so legally, what they're saying is we are required to ask the registrant for accurate data.
Right.
And that's all we're asked to do.
Well, then they have to respond to complaints on it, too. This is where their contractual obligation comes in. But they don't say that I raised this, and several of them denied that they have a contractual obligation to have accurate data in their database.
Steve, would you send, on behalf of the task force, a query to Dan Halloran and Louis Tuton and ask them to give the task force an explanation of what the registrar's contractual obligations are in this area?
Yeah, I could try to do that. I could combine that with something asking Dan to just update what his report from Shanghai. So we
good. Do that. Do that as well if you could. That would be very helpful for all of us, I think. Let me try to move us forward here. What I proposed is the idea that we, and I think what we actually need to do. Maybe we also need to talk further with the ICANN staff about the section of our recommendation, which is about them.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch what you said.
Maybe we need to talk further with the ICANN staff about the sections of our recommendations, which are about ICANN.
Well, it's clear that the WHO is Implementation Committee, in other words, the registrars and registries, are not looking at those.
Right. So I would suggest that we need to talk to them about that Louis needs to respond back to us or in writing, but there needs to be some kind of an exchange because remember that this report is going to go forward to the board, and I believe it is incumbent for the task force to have had a further conversation with the staff.
Sounds reasonable.
We can do that, I think, after we get this next document out and then schedule a conference call with them. I'm not suggesting we try to do it before we turn this around, but I'm just going to table my suggestion for what I call the testbed approach and go on because we need to move forward a bit in time. On the bulk access recommendation. Steve, can you and Richika and Tony say something about that? I'm looking for it here.
Well, the implementation committee just looked at our first recommendation, which was that marketing uses of bulk data shouldn't be permitted, and they agreed with our language, I believe, for how the registrar accreditation agreement should be changed. And then they said there's a need to clarify the definition of marketing purposes. This may require a small working group to define, possibly just in the form of examples, but not limited to, I think something got garbled here, but they basically said there should be, we should try to come up with a better definition of marketing activities because it wasn't totally clear what that meant.
Well, maybe we could go for the contrary and try and come up with a definition of what shouldn't be allowed.
This is a blacklist.
What should be allowed? What should be allowed? Yeah.
Well, we identified that as something that was a good item for future work. So I don't think that the implementation committee said anything very different than what we were saying here.
The problem with something like this is I think it may sort of draw out indefinitely. If it's a little bit like nitpicking.
If I may make a suggestion, maybe we should postpone this particular discussion until after Marilyn has briefed us about the European Commission communication.
Yeah, I was also going to suggest that I might ask Becky to make a comment after I do that. Let me talk about access to port 43 for just a minute. Several of the registrars have expressed concern that... And the data mining, any data mining that is going on is targeted toward Port 43. And any other automated port facilities that a registrar may have set up through individual agreements they may have struck. which one should recognize from time to time registrars do strike those agreements. That completely bypasses the intent of the recommendation of limiting marketing uses of bulk access. I know there was a fair amount of discussion in the implementation group about this and about the fact that it wasn't addressed. Where are we in, but I believe this group has strong concerns about misuse of the WHOIS data for that purpose. Are we able to modify our recommendation or make a new recommendation that addresses the need to limit access to port 43 for non-authorized uses such as marketing? Because right now, registrars are individually taking steps to gate access so that only so many, and I'm going to fall off the wagon here on my ability to explain what they're doing, but they are taking steps to limit the number of attempts, etc. For purposes of legitimate searches, we certainly do not see the need to bombard a registrar who is. But is it possible to say something, even if we can't say that we've reached a consensus, is it possible to say something about the need to limit this, even if it is making a small contribution to spam? It is clear it is making some contribution to building of list. It's not the predominant problem, but it is a existing problem. Can we say something?
I think there are two issues that would need to be explored before. I mean, we could say something very general, but before we could say anything very meaningful, I think there are two issues that need to be explored, and I don't think have been, at least not in this group. One is what are the technological means that could be used to at least minimize the problem? Because I've heard different things from different sources about how effective it is to put these governors, which all of the registries do, with the acquiescence of ICANN. Not all of them do, but many of them do. But I've heard different views about how effective they are. The second point is, of course, that right now, I guess I can't say that about Port 43, but I know on the web-based WHOIS, there are contractual limitations. People who use that query-based service are agreeing not to use it for marketing purposes in some cases. Now, there's a question of how enforceable those agreements are.
But I
just think those are the two issues that would have to be looked at.
There must be something that doesn't work about this, and I'm technically not adept enough to understand what's going on. But I recall with great clarity the fact that at some point in '97. Network Solutions put a governor on the WHOIS database so that people could only get like five names.
That's different. That's a response. That's the number of responses.
Yeah, you're talking about limiting the number of connections to the database.
But that doesn't appear to work anymore.
Well, one problem is that if you're, there are ways to circumvent these governors. For example, if the governor says you can only have X number of queries from an IP address in a certain time period, then you can use multiple IP addresses. But, like anything else, there's a sort of an arms race here, and I think we would just need to understand more about what can or can't be done technologically to solve this problem.
Well, we should explore what we can say about supporting security and securing access to the database and see what we can do policy-wise to enable the registrars to put layers of security around Port 43 and talk about differentiated access and things like that. just based off of like a firewall.
Well, Steve, let me see if I understand what you're saying. I'm not suggesting that the group has done a thorough consensus-based analysis, but I think the group has heard enough expressed concerns about misuse of Port 43, including expressed concerns from the registrars. My own technical people's view is make the small contribution, not no contribution, but a small contribution. But it's feeding, you know, it's sort of people are out data mining and building lists, and then your name gets put into a list and it gets sold and resold and resold. Be that as it may, the complaints we've received, I think, are sufficient that the group ought to be able to say something about misuses of the WHOIS data for marketing purposes. And this is, I think, what I thought we had agreed to. I thought we had agreed that marketing uses of WHOIS data is a misuse of the data.
No, well, I think we didn't have that discussion. I mean, we had that discussion many times in the context of bulk access.
Well, actually, I disagree with you. We had that discussion slightly. We had the discussion many times, and I said it about this way every time. I just want to understand where the task force is. We may have felt that the main place that we could make a consensus recommendation was in bulk access, but I thought the task force's view was that marketing use of the data is a misuse of the data.
I think we have to make one observation in this discussion. Query-based WHOIS is supposed to be used for individual queries. It is supposed to be used for queries for a very limited number of records. The thing which happens is that the Port 43 service is available to anyone and is available freely. So it can be used to automatically obtain bulk data. So you get the practical equivalent of bulk access through Port 43. It is not the same policy-wise, but it is practically the same things. And as we all know, spammers aren't interested in policy or things like that. So the problem is you can get a large portion or even the entire data by doing individual queries to Port 43, you basically remain anonymous. You can't do anything with it, even according to the current agreement. So, for the moment, the stopgap measure would be to ask, do we have any, or do registrars have any means to avoid Port 43 being abused as an instrument for access to a large amount of WHOIS data by a single party? Is that possible? But that's only a stopgap measure. The second question is, of course, can we find an alternative mechanism to Port 43, either a technical alternative or a policy alternative, which ensures at least that access is only possible in small portions and possibly even starts to address other privacy concerns. I think that's the two steps we have in front of us. For the moment, the key question is really how can we avoid bulk access through Port 43? Or is it even impossible? It may be.
Okay. And I think, I have tried to ensure that we find a way to protect non-marketing uses of the data. And I think the other task we have in front of us is to try to delineate what that is so that registrars are in a position to continue to provide legitimate kinds of access, such as research, third-party services which are built and are non-related, they're sort of non-related third-party value-added services?
Well, those are all bulk access issues. But I don't have any problem with Tom's formulation that one of the issues is how can abuse of port 43 be prevented. I guess I would suggest maybe we could support what the Security and Stability Advisory Committee said, which is that we must encourage the development of mechanisms to prevent the harvesting and mining of WHIS data.
Right. Okay.
And that's a very general statement, and there's a lot of questions about how that's best to be done, which we're not really competent to answer, but which could have policy implications.
And so we could include that in our comments. Let's see if people feel comfortable with that. In our comments, we would basically, in accepting the report, we would look at their recommendations, and this is one that we would endorse.
Mm-hmm. Well, one question, if I may raise this one. Should we say anything on the question if whether or not we consider Port 43 WHIS as being something like sacred, if I may put it like this? Do we consider it that way? So could we think about things like email access, reducing things to web access, things like that? Because the WHIS protocol is pretty trivial, and it's extremely simple to write clients for it, which just connect, send a command line, get data back. It's really that trivial. And that the simple protocol doesn't allow for any sophisticated things. So one of the stopgap measures may be to go for some kind of a different protocol, even in the short term. For instance, if you go to emails, it's one of the things which GNR has been doing for some of the information they give out. You get a piece of information about the person doing the inquiry. You get an email address. Now you can start to do rate limiting, for instance, by domain name.
Thomas,
it offers interesting perspectives. I'm wondering if you should make a note that we encourage really opening up the debate, which would, in this case, have policy implications because policy currently mandates a Port 43 service. Note that I'm really just talking about the channel to access the data. I'm not talking about access itself right now.
Thomas, I think that actually this would fall into our issues report as well as something that further work is needed on. And the question may be, because we continue to maintain that access needs to be thoroughly examined, including differentiated access, et cetera, we need to figure out how we address that in an issues report and ensure that we include the question of, for instance, is port 43... Does Port 43 remain, you use the word sacred, that's probably good enough shorthand for it.
I have a comment to make, Marilyn.
Yes.
I don't want to jump the gun because this is another document, but looking at the European Commission document,
they
state that bulk access is in principle unacceptable for any purpose, not only for direct marketing.
Actually, I was just going to turn us to that document, Tony.
I'm sorry, I didn't want to jump the gun.
No, I think it's time to do that. I think everyone has the document. It came to Louis. It was sent to ICANN as a task force, just because of the way that they communicate, not for any other reason. And I send it out to you guys. Again, this is one part of the commission. I was not aware that they were, I'm not surprised that they developed comments, but I was not aware that they were developing comments. Basically, you know, maybe we should just go through the points that are covered there.
Well, I think they're very concerned with accuracy. They seem to support us quite heavily on the accuracy issue.
Right.
And they do get into detail about access, which is quite reasonable, really. They say, you know, you should have a level of access which is basically just a technical contact, and other access should be graded. There should be some safeguards on how you get to the complete data on a registration.
So they are sort of supporting the concept of this differentiated access.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is what it says. So if you want, we can read it all if you want. But
right. And also, Christy, I think for you and Rom, they raised questions about uniformity.
Mm-hmm.
Which they oppose.
Well, you know, I think that's why it's important to have further conversation with them, because you can have uniform data and not make it accessible, and then it does not. I think they are assuming that lack of uniformity creates barriers that will limit people's efforts to access the data.
Where did you read this?
On
the contrary, the Commission does not support the proposals concerning uniformity and more searchable with facilities. In that context, it would like to mention the paper approved by blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but
the use of public directories for reverse or multi-criteria
services. I read it,
right.
And I know it, what they said, but I also cannot find the reason for saying that, at least not the reason that Marilyn is giving.
What I was saying is I suspect that's why, but my previous conversations with them, Abel, I worked with the Commission very closely.
That's why
That's why I think we have to have a conversation.
Mm. Well, in general, I found it was an enlightening document, and
they're suggesting a meeting with us here at the end of the paper. Why don't they come to Rio if it's so cold up there?
I think we probably need to have a conference call with them before Rio.
Okay.
But
send them a picture of what the beach looks like, and you probably get them all there.
Mm-hmm.
Are you sponsoring us all, or?
On page three, first full bullet point. I think it's, you know, this is very apropos to this conversation that we're just having.
Well, finally, ICANN's having a meeting at a super beach location.
Tony, I'm not going to let you distract us by pulling the number of attendees.
Okay.
If you sponsor us, we'll all be there.
Yeah, when this call started, everybody said they were feeling cold.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tony, please return to the topic.
Bullet 2 on page 3.
The topic of the cold, or?
The topic of the European Commission communication to us.
So on bullet, the second bullet on that page, we actually are going to have a conversation with both internal markets and Info Society, because there are two directives, one on privacy and one on privacy and electronic communication. And their interpretation about the implications for the second directive, that's new news to me, that the Commission has actually taken a decision. I'm not surprised.
Go ahead.
I don't think that they view, or at least the last time I talked to Margot Freulinger about it, they did not view WHOIS as a directory service.
Right.
I know. That's why I am surprised to see.
Now, Marilyn, can I just make two observations about this document
Please.
That are relevant here? One is, with regard to this particular question, that directive is the child of the Information Society Directorate,
right.
Not of the Internal Market Directorate, so
right.
I would be take with a grain of salt what the Internal Market Directorate does about what it covers and doesn't cover. Second, I don't think we should, I think it would be a mistake to conclude that this document, although it has come in on letterhead of the Internal Market Directorate, actually represents the view of the Internal Market Directorate. I think it represents the view of some staff person within a unit of the Internal Market Directorate. but I don't think we should take this as the position of the internal market director.
Yeah, I opened in my opening comments about when we first started, I noted that. But I also do think, and I support your statement that a separate consultation has to take place with Info Society about their directive.
Yeah, they've taken the position, or rather at least their director, their commissioner has, that it does not, that WHOIS is not covered by the director. By the directive. Now, it's possible that they've changed that position. I just don't think we should conclude that based on something totally different, someone in a totally different directorate said.
Yeah,
I would like just to echo Steve's comments. We received this letter from Commissioner Liikanen stating that the WHOIS was not included, was not, at least the directory section of the Electronic Commerce Communications Directive would not include the WHOIS.
How long ago was that?
Wait a moment. I don't think that in this letter they are even saying that this particular directive directly applies to WHOIS. I think if you look at this, we have two things which are quoted. What they say is that the Electronic Communications Directive imposes opt-in for commercial email. So at this point, we are basically at the output side of a spammer. And the conclusion, which is regulated by the Electronic Communications Directive, and what they are basically saying is that this regulation of the output side of the spammer should actually be taken to the input side by making bulk access to the data for the purpose of direct marketing also depending on WHOIS, on opt-in. So at this point, I think they are doing a conclusion through the middle of our spammer friend, if I may put it like that. That's one point. The other point is the question of searchability, where they are talking about an opinion on the use of public directories for reverse and or multi-criteria searching services, reverse directories. Now, that particular opinion is from 2000, and it is by the Data Protection Article 29 Working Party, so it doesn't even does not refer to the Electronic Communications Directive from 2002, but does refer to the Data Protection Directive. I think we should be careful in what kinds of arguments are being made here.
Yeah, I agree with you, Thomas. I fully agree. And it's true, this paper of Article 29 was made before the adoption of the Electronic Communications Directive. Then you must know that during the debate in the Parliament on the Electronic Communications Directive, the members of the Parliament debated a lot this question of reverse searching services. So it may be the one of the reasons why the Commission refers to that. There was a political debate on that, and I think it's in fact an interesting issue. And looking at the directive no more in details, the second directive would be a useful work, in fact.
Maybe, Laurence, the thing I was trying to understand, the reason why I just took these arguments apart was that I somehow don't understand how the applicability of the Electronic Communications Directive to WHOIS would have any impact on the arguments made in the letter we have from the Commission. This letter is not based on the assumption that the Electronic Communications Directive is applicable to the WHOIS database.
You mean this document that we have now?
Yes. Their arguments carefully avoid.
Yeah, but to tell you in a very informal way, I asked the question one day to the people working in InfoSoc on whether what they thought about that. I didn't get any specific answer. So it may be possible that the question is not even, they don't really have a clear position yet on this issue. We just have asked the letter of Commissioner Liikanen, which I think is essential, but within
the thing I'm trying to say is that letter does not affect the arguments which are made in the letter we have.
Can we focus then specifically on the arguments, Thomas, that that you identify that are made in this letter that we will need to think about, and then when we put our call together, discuss further. But let me identify one that I'm not really an argument, but it's something that I would like to be sure that we address the staff, and that is the fact that our work I think there's a little bit of an assumption here that we have limited our input to the original survey that we did, and that's an easy one for us to deal with. I just want to be sure we clear up that misunderstanding. The third point is that they are maintaining that the purpose of the WHOIS database is has been considered traditionally as being of a technical and operational nature. And they suggested that we did not even address that as in the possible uses. And I'll have to go back and look at our questions, but I'm quite sure we did address the uses of the data for technical and operational purposes, because many of our responses came from ISPs who rely heavily on the database for that purpose. So I just wanted to mark that question for everyone.
Marilyn, in that regard, I'm glad you raised that point, because it's worth remembering that this document appears to be a response to the paper we posted
in Bucharest.
In Bucharest.
Exactly.
So it's kind of, I would say yesterday's news, but 3 weeks,
right.
8 months ago.
Yeah. Yeah. When I wrote back to them, I mentioned our other documents to them. I just acknowledged this document, mentioned our other documents, and said that Tony and I would be raising the question of how to arrange a consultation with you guys. But, yeah, I agree. Can we just go on with arguments here?
Well, can I just ask, are they looking to talk with us or with ICANN representatives?
They're looking to talk with us and ICANN. They go on to make some comments that I'm going to have to go back and look at the previous paper about the availability of WHOIS data for trademark and copyright purposes.
Yeah, this appears to be a quote from a paper that they circulated to the GAC in November of 2001. We haven't seen that paper, but...
No.
Well, the use of WHOIS data for IP searching... I mean, it's a weird thing here, the way they're sort of describing this as content, but certainly there's no boundaries on the ways in which WHOIS data could be used for self-releasing of IP in the white paper or the green paper.
Yeah, I think that they fundamentally misunderstand how WHOIS data is used in the intellectual property enforcement process, and also I think their argument would be equally, they would have to say that it can't be used to investigate consumer fraud or to find out who's the source of spam or anything else, because these have to do with the content. So I think that this paper kind of misunderstands how this data is used.
Yeah, we were very surprised.
I don't think they read the survey results. They obviously read the survey questions because they complained about them, but I don't think they really read the results.
I don't really understand this private policing they refer to all the time on content.
I think that they're referring to the, amongst others, IP constituency that wants access to the WHOIS. In special circumstances.
Right, they're basically saying that if something is happening on a site, it is inappropriate for you to use the WHOIS to find out who's operating that site or who's registered the domain name to which that site resides. And that argument would be applicable. They apply it here in the intellectual property area, but the same
not
argument
only.
Would apply to consumer fraud or.
It would apply to consumers as well.
Quite frankly, I think they are not misunderstanding the current uses that they have a disagreement with certainly a French party IP constituency about what kinds of users should be made. It's in the, I'm sorry, let me count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 paragraph on page 2. It's the fifth of the italics paragraph where they say, accordingly, if rights holders wish to control that only authorized persons are using their work and thus discourage online piracy through whois queries, and that would require a distinct legal base, at least in the European Union. I don't think they're misunderstanding actual users, but, well, there's certainly some range to the possible interpretation of the legal environment of this.
How do you understand, Thomas, this notion of distinct legal basis?
I think what they're saying is that, that there would need to be some specific law which permits for that kind of access. Now, on the other hand, if you look at things written, for instance, by privacy authorities in member states, let me take the German case as an example. We talked to Sabine about the Enix-Quiz, and you know that they have a settlement, some kind of settlement or agreement or whatever, with their relevant privacy authority, and that privacy authority actually says we find it acceptable that whois information is published to the extent to which it is needed in order to sue a domain name holder. They specifically recognize that as one of the critical uses of query-based whois services. So there is some range of discussion, and I think these guys here, well, Paul on one side, but I don't think they are actually misunderstanding the actual users at this point of time.
Yeah, that's what I would want to comment on, because they say control that only authorized persons are using their works. You know, it's an interesting it's an interesting assumption of how whois is being used to identify someone and to get in contact with them for whatever reason. To Lorenzo's purpose, even consumers use whois for this purpose. Can we go on to the next point about they have doubts that that publication of telephone numbers, of private telephone numbers of individuals, are a problem for several data protection authorities. Again, I believe that varies country by country.
I think that's right, and I think it would be interesting to know what to get more detail on that.
Yeah.
And the basis for that statement.
Yeah. I think it's going to be important to have a conversation with them. I'd like to ask Louis when he could join us for such a conversation, and I think we need to do a little more preparation ourselves for ensuring that what we have is a dialogue where they ask us questions and explain their concerns, and we try to look at our publications and take into account their input, recognizing that they are not by any means the only government who may want to have a dialogue. The GAC, I'm actually sort of surprised that there's been nothing forthcoming from the GAC on their agenda.
Well, I think they're still trying to organize themselves.
Right, right. But I'm thinking that we ought to try to have this call again after we get our next page of report out, but before we go to Rio.
I guess my only concern is that it seems to me that this document is not the product of a debate within internal within DG internal market about a variety of different issues and claims. And I mean, I don't know for a fact, I would be surprised if the folks in DG Internal Market who had responsibility for intellectual property protection were particularly involved in this.
I think you can pretty much assume they weren't.
Well, I guess my question is, would we be more effective letting that sort of internal resolution, or at least internal discussion, take place, rather than kind of taking, you know, engaging in a refutation of this at this point. It's just a strategic question, but it seems to me that folks within DG Internal Market may be better able to reach an understanding with the authors of this document than we would.
I'm not suggesting that we're going to try to reach an understanding so much as I think we need to acknowledge inputs when we've received it and try to clarify misunderstandings or questions. I'm not posing this as a negotiation.
I wasn't suggesting it as a negotiation, except that I don't know. Maybe people have other views on it. My sense is that if our goal is to have them at some level withdraw some pieces of this, it seems to me that we're much more likely to accomplish that goal if we haven't gotten their backs up.
I was hoping we wouldn't get their backs by pointing them to our new documents. Becky, I think the other activity that we do need to be very sensitive to the fact that we are a task force of the council, and so probably we should go back to the ICANN staff and ask their guidance on how best to respond.
Yeah, I think that might be useful, because it's hard for me to understand what the status of this document is, both within the ICANN process as well as within the commission process, because, you know, they didn't send in a comment on any of our reports, and then this is sent to the ICANN staff, so it's not clear who is supposed to respond to this. They asked for meetings with ICANN representatives. I don't think this task force is an ICANN representative. But that just needs to be clarified, what the expectation is.
Let me go back to Louis by email and ask him to give us advice on and ask him what kind of response. Since he forwarded this to us for response, I will repeat those sort of, we are interested in the status of the documents. We're interested in how the ICANN staff itself views the need to respond, and I am concerned about something. I don't think it's appropriate. We are trying at ICANN now to improve the communication between the GAC and the policy council, and there will be liaisons from the GAC to the council, and participation possibly by GAC members on the task forces if they choose to do that, or at least by their liaison. I don't want to be in a position where a task has been sent a communication by a governmental entity and doesn't even acknowledge it or doesn't respond to questions. But I agree that we need to ask the ICANN staff what the status of the document is and what their plan is to respond as well.
And Marilyn, this is Christy. Can we ask them or find a way to prepare to ask them to qualify their concerns?
Well, I was thinking that actually we could point them to our later document when it's published, which I think would begin to answer some of their questions, since the issues report on uniformity and searchability will raise some of the concerns about it.
Yeah, their concerns were included, I think, in our last report as well.
Right. Any other comments?
Well, just as a suggestion to the searchability issues group, maybe that opinion, footnote 6 on page 3 of the EC document, is something we should refer to in the issues report. I suppose it will. I haven't read the opinion, but I suppose it will address some of the identify some issues which will also have there, and it wouldn't be wrong to reference it somewhere, I suppose. What do you think?
That's great. I think we should read it first.
Yes, of course. But if it's roughly what can be expected from this document, then it should be referenced.
Yeah, there's certainly value here.
Okay, guys, we have 15, maybe 10 minutes, and we need to figure out what we're going to do with our final report. Thomas has distributed. Thomas, can you just tell us the changes that you did make in the...
Well, only the obvious ones. I replaced the section which says this document is open for comment until 9th December by a section which says this document was open for comment until 9th December. Then came the names consultation. Then it was reopened for comment until don't ask you ask me when in January.
Okay.
I have renumbered the I have replaced chapter 12 appendix by two appendices. A and B. A is the current list of task force members, and B is just the summaries of the comments we have received after the quality report was published. This is some combination of things I wrote and the stuff, and the nice, don't let me call the stuff, and the nice summary Steve sent to the list. Thanks for that again. I haven't done anything substantial beyond besides that. I'm not sure if we actually should put these things, these summaries into the appendix, or should extend the outreach chapter of the report by saying, by putting it in the end of chapter 6, that may be more appropriate. But that's a question how we are generally going to attack this. Are we going to make changes throughout the text, adopt changing some recommendations, or are we basically going to produce either a new chapter or an entirely new document, basically a new document which says, here are our final recommendations, taking into account the implementation committee's work and our own personal discussions, and this is based on the following comments received in response to the policy report and on the policy report itself, and here's the policy report. So we have two options here, I think, and we should quickly decide which one to take.
I think you're right. There are two options. Can we hear comments on both?
Well, if I may comment myself, I think that it's clearer to have a document which starts out with the updated recommendations and updated policy recommendations and then basically says that replace recommendations based on policy reports, and that we have that we continue to recommend the maintain the non-policy recommendations we have in that report. Things like I can staff should do ABC. I think we should better put it into a brief document instead of throwing another 30 pages at people which are mostly known to them.
And then this would be a historical document.
Basically, this would be a historical document, or it would be included in the end or something like that. But the thing I would like to achieve is that people have to read a very limited number of pages which clearly say what we are recommending at this point of time, and that the remaining, that the old report, well, is clearly separated from that and maybe basically is frozen.
Are we going to, where would we put the comments that were received in the extended period? Would they go in this report or would they go in the new report?
They would go into, well, I thought this report was a new report. They would go into the new document and basically I think they would do something like, if we do it in reverse chronological order, first thing would be updated recommendations. Second thing would be comments received in response to the... Second thing would be Steve's chapter about the implementation committee. Third thing would be comments received in response to the policy report. And fourth would be the policy report itself or a link to it. I think we should really try to keep this as short as possible in order to have it workable.
The only thing that I... feel uncomfortable about is not including the recommendations to ICANN. I would think we should have the policy recommendations first, and then we should have the recommendations to ICANN, because And otherwise, I feel very comfortable with that. Anyone else?
I'd support what Marilyn said, Christine.
Yeah, it sounds all right.
Okay, so we have Chapter 1, recommendations. A, policy. B, good advice, whatever.
Right.
Second would be implementation committee.
Now, with regard to that, I don't know where we left it after our discussion. I detected a lot of unhappiness or reservations about the generally positive tone of what I circulated. I'm not sure where we left it.
I'm not sure. I think actually there was general positiveness about much of what's in it, but that there were two or three areas where there...
Well, we got into the discussion about changing one of our non-policy recommendations regarding the common form and so forth.
Right.
But are people, we need to come to closure, not necessarily right now, maybe after people have looked at it again. We can come closer on whether that's what we want to say about the implementation committee report, or do we want to say something about, I think someone said they were disappointed that the registrars don't seem to want to take any other steps to improve accuracy, including getting human beings involved, perhaps at an earlier stage in the process. I mean, I agree with that statement, and I'd be glad to insert it, but I don't know whether... That's what people want to have inserted there.
I don't think that it adds anything. I mean, I just think it is in the content.
Well, Becky, you may be right, but I think at some point there, the concerns that the task force has about data accuracy being taken as a serious responsibility does need captured in some way, and maybe we've captured it sufficiently in previous writing.
May I make a suggestion? I think that Steve has some fairly specific suggestions about this process outlined in Section 3E of the Implementation Committee's report. Quite frankly, I have reservations about the process too, because I just don't see it work. My recommendations may in some cases be fail-safe in a different direction, like rather keep the domain name than deleting it. But the fundamental concern is similar. So I'm wondering if the easiest and most appropriate thing for us to do in that case would just be to say that we have reservations about the practicability of this one, that we recommend that the process suggested by the implementation committee be adopted, like the test-bed approach Marilyn proposed, and that we then say that it should be monitored both for effectivity and for possible negative side effects by ICANN staff with a report due in 6 months, something like that. I think that should be a reasonable thing to do from both points of view, since I don't think that we will have a possibility to come up with a new process right now.
So, Thomas, let me see if I understand what you're saying. Are you saying everything up through paragraph E would be accepted?
I would say less. Sorry.
With this monitoring period and report period? Or?
That's what I'm saying, because I don't see that we are able to make up a safe and effective process quickly when the registrars don't get it done on the task on their implementation committee either. So I would suggest that we don't propose a replacement for the process which is there, but that we do suggest that it should prove that it works and that it is safe within something like 6 months.
But when you say the process that is there, what are you referring to? Are you referring to what's in the implementation committee report?
That is proposed. That's not yet there. But that's the problem.
You're talking about what's on page 2 of 3 of the implementation committee report?
I'm talking about the process which is
suggested by the implementation committee in order to track responses. It's,
so
so
that, yeah, I just want to
part three thing. I don't have the implementation report in front of me.
But the problem is part three, it ends with this thing about having ICANN accredited dispute resolution agencies, which don't exist yet, and so forth. So that's why I'm saying, are we saying everything up to that point should be put into effect and see how it works? Or
well, the suggestion was to say everything, including that one. If they can figure out how to get these agencies working quickly, then that's fine. If they can't figure out how that works, then then this proposal will have to be replaced.
I think they would agree that they can't get that up and running quickly. I mean, I don't think they believe that that will be a quick process.
Well, what are we going to say without them either having week-long discussions among ourselves on designing a better process and without...
Well, what I had suggested is we say that we don't accept that part of it because it contemplates the development of an entire dispute resolution procedure, which does not exist. This is a worthwhile topic for further discussion. And then I make a suggestion about how they ought to deal with it in the short term with regard to implausible data that is submitted by a registrant or when a complainant submits further evidence establishing that the new data submitted by the registrant is materially false. I mean, it's not a perfect solution, but at least it gives some guidelines for them to use until this future dispute resolution procedure is in place, if it ever is.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my suggestion. I you know, obviously I'd welcome comments on it, but...
Steve, I have a suggestion as well, and maybe what I'll do is mark up language, but I wanted to raise a question for Bruce has suggested to me that it is possible that if we go forward with sticking to 15 days, that we could find ourselves in a situation where we are outvoted on that point by the Names Council, and a substitution suggested that we could actually get this voted down at the Names Council. And when I did the tally on votes, I think he's right. I'm concerned enough about that. And I wanted to run a compromise past people to think about, and then I'll put it in writing. My compromise would be that we propose that 15 days remain, but that the ICANN board instruct staff to demonstrate leniency in the implementation of the 15 days while a policy process is quickly undertaken to evaluate what the appropriate time frame is. So that would leave the 15 days in place because it is, after all, an existing contractual requirement. It would give the board and the staff some leniency in implementation of 15 days if it's a non-email notice, and it would require the establishment very quickly of a process to assess whether or not to change the time.
Well, we have recommended that there be a process to look quickly at whether or not it's important, starting with data collection about what...
I know. I'm just telling you, that, and I urge you to do what I did, which is count the votes. I'm trying to prevent the task force, and I could be counting the votes wrong. I'm happy to talk about that. But I'm trying to prevent the task force from finding ourselves in a situation where the Names Council votes against us or a major part of our recommendation.
Could we all say or, you know, with that statement, have it be an if-or statement? And if they don't like our 15 days and want to see if we need a different time frame approach, then perhaps we could say or we change it to the number that the Names Council sees fit between 30 and 90 days and provide also an opportunity for those with intellectual property concerns to have a different mechanism which is more quickly implementable. I mean, isn't that what Bruce was asking us to do in his first written document. I thought I saw that somewhere, that he wanted to separate the concerns of the IP constituency from general.
Well, Species commands that accurate enforcement mechanism should be limited to just that, and should not become a tool for any other purposes. Sorry, I can't understand anything because someone is talking on the phone in the background.
Yeah.
If the person hears this, please shut up or mute. I'm sorry, but it's...
That's understandable. I think also... I think we need...
From the driveway.
Abel?
Yes? You are very hearable on this call.
We're able to hear your conversation.
Okay, sorry.
The mute button on my phone is broke, so I have to do it with my hand.
#01
Yeah, if it was working on this one, Thomas, I would have tried it, but it isn't.
Gentlemen, I think we actually need to close this call with a lot of unanswered questions and undertake this discussion, this particular discussion, on email. And I, Steve, am happy to. I am not trying to change our recommendation. I am trying to keep us from being voted down, and because I think that once we're trying to get consensus policy approved, and so I'd like for people to think about if we need to have a substitute, however we approach this, that I'd prefer that the task force previously consider the need for substitute language and reach an agreement on substitute language, and not put those of us who are on the task force and also on the Names Council in the position of having to draft on the fly without the benefit of your participation and consultation. So that particular issue I'd like people to think a little bit about and for us to email about. Can we send our comments back to you, Steve, for editing?
Comments on the...
On the draft?
Yes.
And I suppose that I should start to take the latest text from the implementation committee, Steve's document, and start to draft what will become the final report.
If you could, that would be wonderful.
I will try to do it. I should have the time, actually. So we have another call on Thursday, on Friday, is it?
Right.
Yeah, I'll try to circulate something 12 hours before that.
Okay. And if we can get our comments into Steve... Ritchie, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
You have had a burst of input, is that right?
I'm sorry, Marilyn?
You had a lack of significant numbers of input, is that right?
For the privacy issues report, that's correct.
So,
sorry, I've been otherwise occupied, but I will give you some.
Okay. Can others try to pay attention to that?
She'll get a big list from us, but not, I mean, for a while. We're not ready yet.
Right, and she's not on... she's not on the same deadline, but just, you know, let's try to...
What is her deadline?
Well, all of the issues reports are going to have to be done and ready for Rio, not for the 20th of February. So I think you've got, like, the first couple of weeks in... you've really only got the first couple of weeks in February to get the issues reports together so that we can get them posted, because they do have to be posted for 20 days.
Oh. Okay, Ram and I were thinking we had the full month of February to create the issue reports. We thought they were due the 1st of March. That's how we set the whole schedule. But we can modify this, but it is how we set the schedule.
We have this 20-day requirement that, and the way it goes right now is people will be leaving for Rio probably on the 20th, 21st.
I'm going to have to jump off, guys.
Yep.
All right, well, man, let's talk about this later.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Friday, same number.
All right. Bye.
What time, Marilyn?
11.
Okay. Friday, 11?
Yes.
It's impossible. I can join about 12.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye.